We're talking about the question of creation science tonight, and what is it? If you've heard it discussed in the media, and that is your source of information, then you don't have a clue. So often we're told it's all about Genesis, two naked people running around in the garden talking to snakes. It's about beginning with the conclusion, then trying to confirm it. These are ideas that typically are representing creation science to the minds of people in the United States based on what the media tells us. Let's begin with a definition from the Supreme Court, from Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice Scalia, both of whom are recently deceased, but they authored a decision describing creation science from a case down in Louisiana where they had proposed balanced treatment of creation evolution, which the court decided was unconstitutional for reasons that we'll show later. But in this decision, the comment was made regarding the definition of creation science. We have no basis on the record to conclude that creation science need be anything other than a collection of scientific data supporting the theory that life abruptly appeared on the earth. Now, is that what you hear as the definition of creation science in the media? Hardly. It's scientific data. They had 53 scientists testify. And based on what was on the record, they all indicated that it was scientific data and then an evaluation of that data. But how do we look at scientific data and determine the difference between creation and evolution? Some would say, well, you've got to have the Bible to reach the conclusion about creation, and I think that's a rather naive view. We look, for example, at this rock and think about its origin. Did someone design that? It's possibly, but not likely. It probably just happened that way. Time and chance would be a good explanation for what we're looking at. But you look at this rock, and do you think that happened all by itself? No, this is created design. And we reach that as a result of a religious conclusion or because of the empirical evidence. And we're told if you reach the conclusion of created design, it must be religious. I don't think so. I think it's very obvious from the empirical evidence in this instance that we have created design. We look at this fly, and he has ants on the wing. This, of course, is a drawing, and that came from the ink bottle, but did it come as a result of just spilling the bottle and letting it run across the page? We see, I think, obvious design, and it would be rather foolish to conclude that something this ornate on the wings just happened that way. But when you look at the peacock fly, this is not something that has a drawing on the wings. This is the way it grows. It's an absolutely amazing creature. When it was first described, the scientists said, well, there must be some kind of a symbiotic relationship here with ants actually living on the wings. But no, this is the way the wing, I would say, is designed. We would say that with a drawing. We see the same thing on a living item. Why wouldn't you say this is designed? We see arrowheads all the way through nature. Another example would be if you're walking down the beach and you see these lines parallel to the waves, and you raise the question, are these lines natural? They seem to be ordered. But did that order come about by someone designing it, or did the waves do that? Well, I think we can tell pretty clearly that the waves did that, especially when they disappear and then reappear with the waves coming in and out. You walk a little further down the beach and you see John loves Mary. You think the waves did that? I don't think so. When you have information, especially, it is obvious this comes as a result of intelligence. And I think that's a conclusion that we can reach just pretty obviously. Information implies intellect, design, intelligence. And I would challenge anyone to find examples that would contradict that. I think we see obvious evidence of that throughout nature. Let me give you some more examples that would help emphasize, illustrate that point. Beginning with some excavations that were done at the site of ancient Tyre, fairly recently, we're told, and they were excavating and found a recipe for what was called oracle soup. The oracle was a means of the gods communicating with the people. Of course, their suspicious view of the gods. And they cooked up soup, and the soup was a means of communication. And so they followed the recipe and cooked up some of that oracle soup that they had found in the excavation. Initially, there was nothing there, but they continued to cook. And as they cooked, they found that something developed. It said, "Watch out for large wooden horses." You buy that? I don't think you buy that. Why? Because this is information, and that's not just going to be cooked up in the soup, is it? You know that that's not possible. If you have "watch out for large wooden horses," somebody with intellect is designing that. And yet, when you look at the primordial soup, as it's often called, that Darwin says is the origin of life, you have way more information, as we'll see, than what's involved in the oracle soup. And I don't think that happened by itself either. When you look at machinery, you understand this is designed. Engineers will make it very clear to you that it's not easy, and it is an obvious indication of design. We look, for example, at the bacteria with the tail that is run by what can honestly be called an outboard motor. It's described here in Science 2017 as a rotary nanomotor that allows a bacteria to propel themselves through liquids across surfaces. A machine that self-assembles on the nanoscale. Now, where do machines come from? Our observation indicates they come from engineers and from designers, don't they? In this case, you have a rotor, you have a stator, you have O-rings, bushings, U-joint, drive shaft, as you find in an electric motor. And that's what turns the tail so that it becomes a motor. It turns at 100,000 revolutions per minute. You try that with your car, and you're going to have parts flying in all directions, aren't you? You get past 7 or 8, 10,000, look out, it's coming apart. But 100,000 is unthinkable. It has a network-controlled clutch and brakes. It has over 30 coordinated functioning parts, so that this part is necessary for this part to function. All of them are necessary, or nothing works. Now, do you think that just happened by itself? An engineer will tell you that's not conceivable. This same article, 2017, "The Bacterial Flagellum Exemplifies a System Where even small deviations from the highly regulated flagellar assembly process can abolish mobility. Not only do you have to have all the parts, you have to have them assembled in the right order. Part A, part B, part C. If you get it out of order, then it's not going to work. Now, you remember, Darwin says if you don't have all of it, if you can't just do it step by step, each part leading to the other, it's absolutely not going to work. It would destroy his theory. But the kind of information that we see in the cell has just exploded in recent years as we've learned more about the simple cell, which is a nonsensical term. Yeast would be one of the simplest organisms. And here in 2018, in science, or in cell systems, yeast has been subjected to the most comprehensive analysis measurement of absolute molecules per cell. How many molecules in a yeast cell? Well, Darwin looked at the cell and thought, you know, here's protoplasm and just like jello, a black box was a term that was used. There are, according to this article, 210 trillion with a T molecules in this simplest cell. Now, those molecules fit together into what is effectively a machine, 42 million machines defined as proteins. The article says, like machines invented by humans, these protein assemblies contain highly coordinated moving parts. The machines are spinning to and fro, turning about various axes, a million rotations per second. Now, you thought 100,000 revolutions per minute was fast. A million revolutions per second are going on inside the cell. 42 million machines in the simplest cell we know about. Now, that's information, that's design that Darwin knew absolutely nothing about. He said, in Origin of the Species, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, you get this part and it works fine, and then you add another little part and it works better. No, these parts all have to be there or nothing works. And the parts are just mind-boggling. If that's not the case, he said, my theory would absolutely break down. And when we look at the bacterial flagellum, or the yeast cell, I think we see obvious indication of design, more so than the arrowhead, or John loves Mary, or look out for large wooden horses, which we would never believe happened by itself. But this kind of machinery clearly indicates intelligent design. Now, observation tells us that machines are designed. How many of you have ever seen a machine that was not designed? That's what we see. That's what science is, what we observe. Therefore, design is the scientific explanation. Now, this is what we're talking about when we're talking about creation science. Sometimes people will say, well, it's all about the God of the gaps. I just can't imagine how this could have happened, and the failure of imagination is our argument. No. What we're saying is that observation indicates that machines are designed, and we see machines all the way through nature. Therefore, the scientific explanation is design. That's what science is. And when we look at things like the bacterial flagellum, it becomes very obvious. Notice the comment that's made by Richard Dawkins, one of the leading evolutionists in the world, sometimes called the Pope of Evolution, from Oxford. He's defining biology in his book, The Blind Watchmaker. He says, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. That's what biology is. Of course, he doesn't believe it was designed, but that's what it looks like. And I'm thinking, well, maybe it's what it looks like, which is the way scientists are supposed to go with the evidence. Look like practically an ingenious physicist or engineer. Francis Crick, Nobel laureate, co-discoverer of DNA, says biologists must continually keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. I mean, it looks like it was, but you have to remind yourself, no, it's not what it looks like. That's called blinders. You don't want to look in certain directions. That's not allowed. And when you get into the classroom today, we're no longer allowed in many instances to talk about intelligent design. Or you could say no intelligence allowed in the classroom. What we see is that both evolution and creation can be investigated scientifically. We see this in everyday life. We know John Loves Mary was designed, and the arrowhead. Both of them can be investigated, but both of them have profound religious implications. Now, often we hear, well, this is religious and this is scientific, and so you can have one in the classroom and not the other. Again, a very naive conclusion. Both have profound religious implications. Let me give an example from a statement by Richard Dawkins, and if we've got our technicians here working efficiently, and I believe we do, we'll be able to hear in his own words his statement of the implications, the religious implications.
What was the defining moment where you made a decision that you didn't believe in God? Or
yes, I suppose I switched from Christian theism to some sort of deism round about the age of 14 or 15, and then switched to atheism round about the age of 16.
And was there a particular point that, or something that you read or an experience you had that sort of said, yeah, this is it, God doesn't exist?
Oh, well, by far the most important, I suppose, was understanding evolution. I think the evangelical Christians have really sort of got it right in a way in seeing evolution as the enemy, whereas the more, what should we say, sophisticated theologians who are quite happy to live with evolution, I think they're deluded. And I think the evangelicals have got it right in that there really is a deep incompatibility between evolution and Christianity, and I think I realized that at the age of about 16.
But no religious implications. Hardly. Both have profound religious implications. Isaac Asimov, one of the most prolific atheists, writing over 600 books, said, "I have faith and believe myself. I believe nothing beyond natural laws is needed. I have no evidence for this. It's simply what I have faith in and what I believe." But no religious implications. No, a very obvious religious implications. He's chosen to be a naturalist, like some choose to be Catholic or some choose to be Methodist. And not because of evidence, it's philosophically what he wants. And he believes it because he's chosen to. But people will say, no, it's just strictly science. But it's amazing what an unbeliever has to believe in order to be an unbeliever, that nothing created everything, that a big explosion produced the ordered universe, that molecules self-assemble and become living cells, and errors in information produce more information. Now, believing that is amazing. The unbeliever believes that there was nothing, and then nothing happened to nothing until nothing magically exploded for no reason, creating everything. And then a bunch of this everything magically rearranged itself for no reason into self-replicating bits, which turned into dinosaurs and eventually into people. Now, that takes a lot of faith. And I don't think it's a very reasonable faith. I think it's a blind faith. But they're told that in the books as propaganda, and they just, like little robins, gobble it up uncritically, and we support it with our tax dollars. Naturalistic humanism is defined by the Supreme Court as a religion, but that is what's taught exclusively in the classrooms in many instances. I don't think that's American, let alone legal. But we're told everything else is illegal. You have to teach evolution. And I don't believe that's true either, not because I'm a legal authority. But again, going to the Supreme Court, notice the statement from the Balanced Treatment Act. The majority opinion was issued by Brennan, who said, here's why we rule this unconstitutional, this balanced treatment idea. Because the act did not grant teachers a flexibility it did not already possess. To supplant the present science curriculum with the presentation of theories besides evolution about the origin. You already had the right to do this, so you don't need the law, is his point. Teaching a variety of scientific theories about the origin of humankind to school children might be validly done with a clear secular intent of enhancing the effectiveness of science education. Not to teach the Bible, but to teach the best scientific evidence. Yes, you can teach alternative views. The scientific evidence that we've been presenting would be validly done, according to the Supreme Court. So the idea that it's illegal is just not so, and some of the school superintendents need to understand that. When this law was ruled unconstitutional, the press told the world, now then creation science is illegal, which is obviously not the case. In fact, Stephen Gould, one of the more famous evolutionists from Harvard, was interviewed right after the decision was rendered. He said, no statute exists in any state to bar instruction in creation science. It could be taught before, it could be taught now. And we need to inform people of that. But in spite of the propaganda, the truth is winning and making significant progress. A poll that was published 2012 by Gallup indicated that God created humans in their present form measured at 46%, whereas God guided evolution was 32. The kind that's taught in the classroom, God had no part, 14%. And so that's a significant advantage that we have over the others, at least in terms of what most people think. That was in 2012. 2016, a survey was taken nationwide testing two different propositions. Teachers and students should have the academic freedom to objectively discuss both sides of the scientific strengths and weaknesses of the theory of evolution. 93% agreed with that. But the school systems typically do not. The second proposition is important for policymakers and the public to hear scientists with differing views. 94% agree. But that's ruled against if you're trying to show evidence for creation, unfortunately. What is the percentage of scientists who accept the possibility of creation as opposed to evolution? And that this is favored by the evidence. There was an interesting article that was published back in 2001 in the New Republic stating that here are a number of scientists who doubt Darwinism. They listed their names in public. There were over 100 that did. That has continued to gain momentum, and now then over 1,000 scientists have signed the statement that says we doubt that Darwinism can explain what we see in the world. All of them with doctorates in the natural sciences, including scientists from the U.S. Academy of Science, Russian, Polish, Czech national academies, from such universities as Yale, Princeton, Harvard, Stanford, MIT, Columbia, Purdue, Berkeley, UCLA, Duke, Cambridge, Oxford, University of Washington, Washington State, Seattle Pacific are included. Professors that are signatories to this statement, we doubt that Darwinism explains what we see in the world. In spite of this list of over 1,000, and many of them would not simply because they're going to lose tenure, they're going to be discriminated against, their career is over if they're thought to be creationist. But 1,000 of them had the courage to stand up and say, we doubt this. In spite of that, we have men like Ernst Mayr of Harvard, who says no educated person any longer questions the validity of the so-called theory of evolution. That's just not so. And furthermore, he knows it's not so. And it's well documented, but that's what he says. We know it's a fact, and therefore he says nobody that's educated denies it. Interesting statement by Eugene Scott, who is of the National Center for Science Education, which sounds like a national government organization. It isn't. It's just a watchdog group from Berkeley. But she's often quoted when you want somebody to favor evolution. And in New Scientist, she said, scientists should refuse formal debates because they do more harm than good. But scientists need to counter the creationist message. So they quit debating because it doesn't do them any good. And that's right. She learned that. But you need to counter the message when they're not there to answer. Now, I've had the privilege of debating a number of times. The last time that we had a debate scheduled was at LSU with the head of the geology department. It had been scheduled for almost 6 months. And when we got there, the auditorium was full, running over the big auditorium in the geology department. But the professor didn't show. So I won. We spoke for an hour and then had Q&A for another hour. Some of them stayed till midnight. It was interesting that the organization, the campus organization that put on the debate, made those who attended, over 500 of them, fill out cards. And from those cards, they determined that 54% of the ones who attended were creationists, which was probably disproportionate to the general population of the school. I think creationists were more interested in the evidence. But 2 weeks later, they did a follow-up. This was the case when they walked in. 2 weeks later, it was 87% creationist. So teach him not to show up. Or maybe he understands why. But no, it doesn't do them any good to debate the issue. Richard Dawkins illustrates the procedure that's typically being used on the college campus today. He says, you go beyond humorous ridicule. You sharpen our barbs to a point where they really hurt. I think they're likely to be swayed by logic and reason. No, by a display of naked contempt. Nobody likes to be laughed at. Nobody wants to be the butt of contempt. And so this is the way you debate when they're not there to answer. The illustration of that would be P.Z. Myers from University of Minnesota talking about intelligent design. He said, calls them theocrats, faith healers, snake oil artists. I say blankety blank the polite words, careful rhetoric. It's time for scientists to break out the steel-toed boots, brass knuckles, get out there and hammer on the lunatics and idiots. Real scientific dialogue. But that's the best, I think, they can do. Darwin's view is interestingly in contrast to that, expressed in Origin of the Species, when he says, a fair result can only be obtained by fully stating and balancing the arguments, facts and arguments, on both sides of each question. And I find myself agreeing with Darwin, because he was being discriminated against and wanted a hearing, and the situation has changed. But this will give us a setting of what ought to be and what ought not to be, and what hopefully help you see what creation science is, but we certainly need to define terms carefully. What do we mean when we're talking about evolution? G.A. Kirkut is an evolutionist, University of Southampton. He wrote the book Implications of Evolution. And in it, And defining evolution, he makes, I think, a very important distinction. There's a theory which states, he says, that many animals can be observed over the course of time to undergo changes so that new species are formed. We can see changes that are sometimes called new species. A cow gets longer horns, dogs get spots. You can see variation. They're still cows, they're still dogs. But you can see that, and that he calls the special theory. I would call it horizontal variation. That's demonstrated with dogs, for example, that vary within the kind, but not the issue. He continues saying, on the other hand, there's a theory in which all the living forms in the world have arisen from a single source, which itself came from an inorganic form. This is the general theory of evolution. Now, some would object to horizontal variation being called the special theory, but as long as you define the terms and understand the meaning, then we can stand that. But notice that it is very different from what is being promoted, all from a common ancestor. The general theory is a change from one kind to another kind, and that is, I would say, not observed at all. That is the real issue. Two very different ideas. One we can see, the other we can't see. And therefore, I think one is scientific and the other isn't. This is what the conflict is about. But now, how do you tell the difference? Well, some think it's by shouting louder or being meaner, really hurting with the barbs. But the scientific method involves observation and repeatability and experimental procedures, falsifiability. And these are the four criteria of saying this is proved scientifically when you establish these four points. Well, how does that relate to the issue then of evolution? Well, in the living world, is evolution observable? And most would say no, not observable. J. Leonard Stebbins of Harvard says the reason the major steps of evolution have never been observed is that they require millions of years. Okay, if it takes millions of years, you wouldn't see it, but then that's the first criteria of the scientific proof, is observability. And he admits, no, you don't see that general picture. You know, you see some horizontal variation, but not the general theory. Well, that's the living world. In the fossil record, you're able to see over those millions of years, we're told, and the fossil record documents the change, or does it? We'll talk more about that later, but notice the statement by Stephen Gould of Harvard. He says, the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontologists. We view our data as so bad, we never see the very process we profess to study. We'll document that more, Lord willing, Thursday evening. Observable? Not in the living world, not in the fossil record either. Takes millions of years, and the fossil record basically, he says, it went so fast it didn't get recorded. It went too slow and it went too fast. They don't see it in either case. What about the other two, repeatability and experimental requirement? Ernst Mayr of Harvard says evolutionary biology, in contrast with physical chemistry, is a historical science. Physics, chemistry, no, you can see that. That's the hard science. But historical science? The evolutionist attempts to explain events and processes that have already taken place. Laws and experiments are inappropriate techniques. When you're talking about the general theory, you're talking about historical conclusions that are not repeatable. You think man evolved from Australopithecus. Okay, can you experiment and demonstrate that? Well, no, that's a historical event, not repeatable or experimental. Probably the most unfamiliar to a general audience is the fourth requirement, that of falsifiability, which is basically testability. We're told if you can't come up with a test so that if this happens, it's verified, if this happens, it's falsified, then you really can't call it science. Colin Patterson of the British Museum of Natural History says, this is the largest fossil museum in the world, he's recently deceased, in his book Evolution, says, this is unique, unrepeatable, like the history of England. Unique events, by definition, are not a part of science, for they are unrepeatable and not subject to test. So if you're talking about the general theory, no, you can't falsify, you can't set up a test. And so in all four instances, evolution fails. Jerry Cohn, one of the most vicious anti-creationists in our country, University of Chicago, says evolutionary biology is a historical science laden with history's inevitable imponderances. We evolutionary biologists cannot generate a Cretaceous park to observe exactly what killed the dinosaurs. We usually cannot resolve issues with simple experiments. These are historical processes. All four are criteria that are not met by evolution. We also need to observe that that's also true with creation. You can't repeat that. You can't observe and test or potentially falsify, so that honestly, neither is subject to absolute scientific proof. That doesn't mean that either of them or neither are outside of the realm of science. Science doesn't always operate in areas where you have proof. They can be investigated scientifically, and usually when they're not subject to proving techniques, it's under the heading of model comparison. We don't see the interior of the sun. We can't observe, but we make models and we see what fits best. And with regard to these two issues, we look at biology and microbiology and physics and geology and paleontology, and we see, does this work best with creation? Does this work best with evolution? Now, you don't reach proof conclusions. They're probabilistic, but you see the model is better if it explains the data best. Sometimes it's called the principle of Occam's razor or the principle of parsimony, which just says, this fits the facts better, more directly and simply. Now, you can make any model fit with enough secondary and tertiary assumptions, but which one fits directly and simply with the fewest assumptions, that's the better model. That's the proper procedure when you're dealing with things not subject to scientific proof, and neither creation and evolution are. So, using this methodology, that of model comparison, let's look at what Darwin saw and see which model fits the data best. He traveled around the world as the ship's naturalist on the Beagle, and saw some strange animals that he hadn't seen in England, especially when he got to the Galapagos Islands. He saw strange-looking turtles and birds and lizards, reptiles that he hadn't seen before, and began to propose some ideas about it. Especially when he looked at the finches, drew conclusions about 2 years after he got back home, deciding that here is proof of evolution. Now, they're still finches, but some of them have big, thick, heavy beaks, and some of them have little pointy beaks. And they're grouped on certain islands, and the islands that have the little pointy beaks with the finches with pointy beaks obviously are better at reaching into the bark and getting the insects, whereas the ones with the big heavy beaks are better at breaking the seeds. And so he says they evolved under this circumstance, and these evolved under that circumstance. But he didn't see the evolution. He just saw the fact that there are different kinds. At best, we're looking at that special theory, the extra spots, the long horns, like the dog. They are still obviously finches. They didn't become eagles or anything else. He saw, at best, evidence for special evolution. The beak shapes were different, but there was no change from one kind to another kind, and so he saw no evidence for the general theory of evolution. It's interesting that the research there has been in the news fairly recently. There's some very competent scientists who've been watching those finches on the Galapagos Islands. And here it's reported, Darwin's finches evolved before scientists' eyes. Okay, this would be the kind of evidence that we need to support evolution. For the first time, scientists have observed real-time evolutionary changes in one species driven by competition for resources. All right, that's what Darwin said would happen. And here in live science, we're told they've seen that. Well, what was it that they saw? This chart was there describing the Grants research. There was a drought, and as a result of the drought, they could see a difference in the birds that survived. Some of them didn't do too well, others did. And as a general rule, the beaks shrunk, they said, which is not exactly what happened. There were smaller beaks before, there were smaller beaks after, but there were more with smaller beaks, which is not the same thing, isn't it? The rest of the story is that the shrinkage first was less than 1 millimeter. The shrinkage already existed. The smaller size was already there. There were just more of them that survived better in the drought. And then after the drought disappeared, it went right back. Only the relative numbers changed. But what we're told is that Darwin's finches evolved before scientists' eyes. And you're just changing relative numbers of varieties that are already there. Now, I think that's deceitful, but that's the kind of it. And why don't they come up with better evidence than that? Well, if they had it, they would. This is the best they've got. And I find that very encouraging. It's interesting that even more information has produced more doubt about this kind of evidence. Here in 2014, under the headline, Speciation Undone, in the journal Nature, we're told that Darwin's tree finches have collapsed under conditions of hybridization into two species. Now, the textbooks all across the country say there are 14, but they collapsed into two. Not 14, as the textbooks would indicate. It is reversible, so that we're looking at horizontal variation, first this way and first that way, depending on the circumstances, but accumulating change developing into something different, not even close. But that's the claim. We still have continuing propaganda here in 2018 in Science. Darwin's finches prove a mechanism for the rapid formation of new species. That's what they're saying. Well, look at what happened. Not exactly. These birds are evolutionary biologists' most celebrated example of natural selection in action. I think they're right. I think that's the best they got. And that's encouraging. I think it's also important, as we're thinking about what Darwin saw and evaluating it under the two-model comparison methodology, to consider what Darwin didn't see. He didn't see a cowbird or a bird dog, did he? The kind of changes that would be a different, lead to a different kind, no. We look at that and we laugh and we say, wait a minute, that's, who? Anybody believe that? I don't think so. Now, 1 millimeter difference in the beaks that was really already there, but just more of them. Yeah, we can expect that. This we do not see. At best, we see a variation like extra spots or longer horns, like we see with dogs that happen quickly and then reverse, which is not an issue. Now, that's the kind of evidence that's presented in the textbooks, and that's encouraging to a creationist who says, you don't have evidence for the general theory. You also see the pepper moth touted in the textbooks as proof of evolution. And we're told that before the Industrial Revolution, when the bark on the trees was still light-colored, then the two different moths on the tree trunks would be favored, that is, the survival value would be favored for the one that is camouflaged by the light color, and the light ones are going to get along better than the dark ones, and the dark ones are going to get hit more often, right? We understand that. After the Industrial Revolution, with the soot covering the trees, then the dark ones get covered and the light ones show up. And so we see the mechanism that is proposed. The problem is you had light ones and dark ones before, you got light and dark ones after. Now, where's the change from one kind to another kind? Again, change in relative numbers. It was interesting to notice that Harrison Matthews was given the honor of writing the foreword to the centennial edition of Origin of the Species. Great honor in England, and he really aggravated a lot of people. He said, the peppered moth experiments do not show evolution in progress, in the foreword of this centennial edition. For however the population may alter, all the moths remain from beginning to end Bistian Betulera. Same species, light and dark, and relative numbers may shift, may not. But the International Wildlife Encyclopedia says this is the most striking evolutionary change ever witnessed by man. Amen. That's the best you got. I agree with them. That may be the best they can do. But even that has now been reflected on, as Jerry Cohn, of all people, the anti-creationist we quoted from earlier, writes the article, Not Black and White in Nature, and refers to the work of Majerius, who's trying to repeat these processes. He says the most serious process and problem is that Bistian Betulera probably doesn't rest on tree trunks. I've seen them, thousands of them on tree trunks in the textbooks. But he says that doesn't happen. Exactly two moths have been seen in such a position in more than 40 years of intensive research. But we got it in the textbooks all over the place. And it's still being taught. Here's 2011 in Science. Peppered moth, Bistian Betulera, one of the most widely recognized examples of contemporary evolutionary change. That's the best thing to do, or they'd use better. What we actually see is a shift in the relative numbers, horizontal variations, pre-existing, and that's not general evolution. Darwin saw these small variations and assumed they would add up to the big ones. He didn't see the big ones add up, but he assumed that they would. That's just an assumption. Well, we can test that assumption. No, you can't test it. It takes millions of years. We just have faith. They wouldn't say that, but that's what they're arguing. They believe that the little ones added up to the big ones. But that assumption, I believe, has been tested and falsified. And, well, no, you can't. It takes too long. But there are organisms that reproduce very, very rapidly, where you can observe millions of generations in a relatively short period of time. In organisms like the fruit flies, for example. Now, these have been experimented on in college classrooms since early 1900s, and we've subjected them to mutagenic chemicals and all kinds of terrible conditions, radiation, and produced some without wings and some with crazy looking eyes, but they didn't change to anything else. They just were worse fruit flies. It's a wonder PETA hadn't gotten involved with all the torture of these poor fruit flies. Bacteria, of course, reproduce very rapidly. The fruit flies reproduce up to every 2 weeks, a new generation. With bacteria, sometimes every 20 minutes, a new generation. And you can observe this over years and see hundreds, millions, even billions in some instances of generations. So we sidestep the issue, well, it takes too long, you can't see it. What we see is that these are the same kind. Michael DeSalle is writing about the fruit fly in the Encyclopedia of Life Sciences. He says, if mutation were a variation of value to the species, then evolution of Drosophila should have proceeded with extreme rapidity. The facts entirely contradict the validity of this theoretical deduction. Didn't happen. 50 million years of observation, he says, haven't produced anything. We have not seen it modified in any way. And with the bacteria, Braun writing in Bacterial Genetics says bacterial populations apparently do not progress beyond certain boundaries. Yeah, you see a lot of variation with bacteria. I think we see indications of design as they vary to adapt to higher temperatures and lower temperatures. They can't go over to the thermostat and say, it's too hot in here, I'll turn it down. But they adapt and vary, but they stay and within the barriers and do not progress beyond that. That's very obviously demonstrated when we look at fossil bacteria. And here's a report here from 2015. Bacteria look the same as bacteria of the same region 2.3 billion years ago. Now, wait a minute. New generation up to every 20 minutes for billions of years. We ought to get some change, oughtn't we? Nope. Look the same. Indistinguishable from the modern. It has a barrier it doesn't go beyond. Other circumstances like amber preserve for millions of years in many instances, as they claim. Here, 365 animal inclusions trapped tiny drops for over 200 million years. Okay, you ought to see some change here. 356 examples somewhere for 200 million. You ought to see something that's changing. Surprisingly, these microscopic organisms look quite familiar to today's scientists and have undergone few or no physical changes. You can test the assumption that the little ones add up. And when you do, that assumption falls flat on its face. We have two observations. We see variation, but that's not all we see. We see barriers to that variation. The variation that we do see is not what the evolutionist is looking for. They degrade complexity, they're harmful, or at least no more than neutral in the normal environments. A few are useful in limited environments. Sometimes when things go wrong, it helps. If you got a skateboard, you're trying to go down the sidewalk. Okay, that works fine until you get about 3 feet of snow. Well, then if the wheels come off, now you've got an improvement happening. But this is losing something. And that's what you see with mutations. Things go downhill. Well, yeah, it's favorable in some instances, but that's not the way to change to a higher organization. We see variation boundaries, which and we're only allowed to look at one of these observations. In science, back in 1980, Francisco Elia, who is one of the heroes of evolution today, came up with the modern synthesis, the Mendelian genetics and Darwinian evolution is put together to make this modern theory. In science, he is the figure propounding the modern synthesis in the United States. He says, these small changes don't accumulate. Now, that was back in 1980. Well, maybe we found them accumulating. We could give you all kinds of examples of leading scientists who've said that over and over. Senior investigator in evolutionary genomics, the research group, the National Center for Biotechnology. This is one of the, you can't get a higher authority, it would be difficult, than this individual, Mr. Coonan. Writing in Trends in Genetics, he says, this modern synthesis that's taught in all the textbooks, He said it's gone. The traditional tree of life, this Darwin picture of evolution, the natural selection, the main driving force of evolution, he says that's gone. The modern synthesis has crumbled. Apparently not beyond repair, not to mince words about it, the modern synthesis is gone. But it's not gone from the textbooks. It's still there. We look then at the two models, and we see that with regard to creation, you know, there are variations. We predict that the Creator would put within each biotype the capacity to vary to different circumstances, but that there would be boundaries. That fits what we see. Both, I believe, are explained. With the evolutionist, they see variations. They're not really the kind they're looking for, but they do not explain the boundaries, and so they're explaining half of the observation. So which one is the better model? Which explains the data best? Now, this is what creation science is. You evaluate the data. You see which model serves best. That's what creation science is. Now, maybe you didn't know what it was before you came tonight, but that's what it is. It's not about Genesis, if that's what you heard us talking about tonight. We're evaluating the scientific evidence and showing why the facts fit better into the picture of evolution. That's creation science. Now, if we showed that it was much more powerful and convinced you this is a better model, that's okay. That's not the purpose tonight. The purpose was to make sure you know what it is and that what's being told in the media about the definition is simply not true. We're seeing statements like this from the National History Museum. Creationists seek to impose on the population at large by political means a body of religious beliefs derived from literal reading of the King James Version of the Holy Bible, both the Old and New Testament. Now, that's their definition. American Institute of Biological Sciences says creationism is based on solely on religious dogma, stemming from faith rather than demonstrable facts. Is that true? Maybe you didn't know that was a lie before tonight, but I think you know. They're just lying through their teeth. And they come right up to the facts and debate and compare, they're going to lose. And they learned that. And so they quit and they lie. That's not politically correct to say, I guess, but that's the truth. And we need to be able to stand up and say it's not so. When you look at the evidence, I think it is overwhelming. Arrowheads didn't form themselves. And you don't cook soup and come up with look out for large wooden horses. You don't see waves saying John loves Mary. And when you look at the incredible complexity, the design involved even in the yeast cell, it's just obvious for honest people. And the evidences that they propose to illustrate proof don't do that at all, as we've seen. The best they can do is silly. And that's why they don't want to debate. If you're here this evening and haven't confessed your faith in Jesus Christ as God's Son, that's an irrational position. You need to understand faith is based on that which we can defend and we're obligated to, and we can easily. And it is the opposition that won't come up to the bar and say, here's the evidence, doesn't work. Come confessing your faith, a rational faith in Jesus as God's Son. If you don't know the evidence why we believe he's God's Son, give us a chance to show you. But with integrity, either in science or in religion, the good and honest heart is that which God seeks, and I think it makes for good science and good religion. come confessing your faith, repent of your sins, and be baptized into Christ. If you've wandered away, come back while we stand and sing.